From Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Thanks so much for joining me. My guest is Richard Esposito. He is a prize-winning investigative reporter and journalist. His new book is called Jimmy Breslin, The Man Who Told the Truth. Richard Esposito, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Hey, it's great to be here. Thank you.
So glad to have you. For the benefit of our listeners who may not be familiar with Jimmy Breslin, why don't we begin with this most obvious question? Who was Jimmy Breslin?
No, I think I wrote a book about Jimmy Breslin because I thought he deserved to be known. Most people, probably under the age of 50, don't really know him or the era of journalism that sort of began in the 1960s and went all the way up till just post 9/11. When new journalism was really the storytelling device that came to the forefront. And Jimmy had more than 3 million readers at a time, which, if you stop and think about it, is probably the combined circulation of every newspaper in California now, if that. It was a different era, and newspapers were the way people got their news, their opinion, and their judgments on what mattered. And that was Jimmy's forte, telling you the truth, what mattered in the facts of a story. So that's why I thought it was important to write a biography of him, and why I thought it was important for people who might not have grown up in that era to know of him, because he's pertinent to what we care about today, how to tell the truth in a society that's very siloed.
Well, truth has become I don't even know what to say about truth. I mean, it's probably the lack of truth is the root of all of our problems right now. I mean, the fact that there are such things as alternative facts and so on.
It's a little scary. Back during the Vietnam era, Philip Knightley wrote a book called Truth is the First Casualty. And that sums up, just as The Man Who Told the Truth, the title of my book, really what's difficult in our society today. How do people get a set of actual facts that are grounded in things that actually happened and have someone say, and this is what you might think about those facts, rather than people either creating facts, alternative facts, or creating truths not grounded in facts, grounded in their beliefs, their opinion, their bias, their anger, their arrogance. And so that's the era we're in. And it's an important era for people to stop and say, how do I arrive at my own judgments at what is actually going on?
I want to talk a lot more about Jimmy Breslin, but you're a person who has been involved in the news, both on television and in journalism. Is that a distinction? Is there such a thing as television journalism? I suppose there is.
I used to think there was when I was a newspaper guy. I used to wonder what they did, but I can now attest after 17 years of TV that they are hardworking journalists who are really smart people, and they really care about conveying to people the news. They do it in a medium that is different from the one I grew up in. I started when people had typewriters in newsrooms. I was at the very end, and the first computers were coming in when I was 22 years old. Big newspapers, small ones had them already, but big city papers got them later because they had millions of people to deal with, and they wanted to get it right. But it's definitely a world now where digital and online are the mediums of distribution, and those mediums also are mediums that are equally valid for conveying facts and good information. It's just, how do you find it? It's a big landscape now.
The coming of the internet and enabling, pretty much everybody to be to contribute equally to discourse would seem to be a more democratic approach, but in the end, it hasn't proved to be that because how can you tell? I guess credentials stand for something, as it turns out.
Well, one of the reasons the founding fathers had an electoral college is they weren't so sure about democracy themselves, so they thought they'd put a layer on top of it. Yeah. Democracy is a wonderful and imperfect thing, and that everyone has the opportunity to publish or be a citizen journalist is a great thing. It has a big downside, which is, in a sense, people tend to like to listen to themselves. So it's like going to a bar. Everybody's got an opinion, and the only one they really think is true is theirs. Two beers later, they want to fight you over yours. So that's the world of the current world of the internet, not what the people who built the internet at Berkeley and in Washington had in mind. It's question is, how does it shake out? What happens? And I'm an eternal optimist about the intelligence of the American people. I always felt the cab driver was smarter than the editor when I worked at newspapers. So you listen to your reader. And I believe that people will hunger for good information, and that will emerge from what is now a froth. You know, people must get bored with talking about themselves to themselves and only to people who care about the exact same things. Jimmy Breslin was someone who a smart cop I was talking to recently described as, you never knew what he was going to write, whether he was going to be for cops or against cops, but you always knew he was going to be interesting, so you read him. And that's really what you want. You want someone to speak who people who disagree with are willing to listen. People who disagree with you are willing to listen to you. That's civility.
Your book, in some ways, it's kind of an annotated anthology of Jimmy Breslin's writing. I mean, there's a lot of him in your book.
There is a lot of him. It's an annotated American history of 50 years. He attended most of the big events from 1963 through 9/11, and he brought a unique point of view to each of those events. So I felt the best way to tell his story was as it unfolded, quote extensively from what he wrote, rather than try and explicate what he wrote and lose the flavor of it. So I did what I did, telling the stories, but in the story, I felt it was best to quote extensively from his journalism, which in a sense, it's like the early novels. He did a serial across time that was really one big story. And the big story was, I'm here for you, and I'm always going to tell you what things mean, and I'm going to keep bringing you back to those things. The example they teach or taught in schools was the Gravedigger, his story about the man who buried John F. Kennedy after his assassination, Mr. Clifford Pollard. He was a gravedigger. He made, I think, $3.10 an hour. And everybody went to Washington, and everybody stood along Pennsylvania Avenue. And there were more than 10,000 journalists from around the world. And they all captured, you know, the horse with the boots and bootless in the stirrups, and the coffin draped with the flag, and Jackie O standing there with the children. Jimmy skipped that, and he went to Arlington Cemetery, and there was only one person there, Jimmy Breslin. And Jimmy Breslin talked to the man who dug the grave. And in that story, one man digging one hole in the ground, he captured the death of a president, and in essence, the death of hope for something new. It became the textbook story on here's how to tell a story. Sort of it is.
Yeah.
As long as there's somebody else telling the other story, so your reader knows what things are going on, you know?
Right, right. And that, you know, he wasn't the only reporter covering it, but he was the only one telling that.
Exactly. That technique of his to put you there and see the story through the eyes of one human being is how over 50 years he told stories. So that's the serial nature of storytelling in a periodical, in a newspaper in this case. And so when Goodman was killed by the Klan, Freedom Rider.
Right. Mm-hmm. The three.
Jimmy went to his funeral too. And then he went to his grave and watched a man dig his grave. Mm. And the man was muttering, wiping his head with a handkerchief. And Jimmy said, well, what did you say? He said, nothing. They'd written on a little plastic tag the name Goodman. And he was saying, I was just wondering whether people will remember it before it's even worn off the tag. And he did the same technique of putting you in a place where no one else was, to note that it was easier to bury him this time than it might have been in Pennsylvania, Mississippi, when they killed him and buried him in an earthen dam. And he captures everything you need to know. And so that's his storytelling technique. He used the second person very often. He used comic characters that were composites of real people. And he was badly criticized. This isn't news. This isn't how you should do news. But it was. And it made the places he worked very special. And I worked at two of the places he worked when he was there, and one of the places he worked when he had long gone. I could say from my own experience, he really made them special.
Yes. Well, in your book, Richard Esposito, Jimmy Breslin, The Man Who Told the Truth, Jimmy Breslin works at several newspapers. He's unable to hold on to a job. Is that right?
Doesn't it seem like that? It really seems like he couldn't hold a job. And I think part of it was he viewed everything like a broken home. You know, so like his father walked out on him when he was a little boy, and through his whole career, he had a fight with whoever he worked for and quit in anger. I'm never working for these people. They bury my stories in the back with the brassiere advertisements. I quit. I'm never going to write for these people again. I had that fight with him myself. When I was a city editor, I had to ask him to, I was informed that I, as the youngest editor, to tell him he was suspended over an outburst of anger in the newsroom, bigoted anger. So I called him and I listened to him rant in my ear for 10 minutes about the man I worked for, about me. And he never set foot in the newsroom again after that I can remember. It wasn't that he couldn't hold a job. It's that if he held a job, I don't think he could write. So he needed chaos, anger. He needed pain. His insecurity is what he made, like $500,000 a year, and yet he couldn't do his expense accounts, couldn't drive, was always broke. And he needed this in order to write. And then that's not an unusual thing I'm saying. I mean, you've heard it about other creative people. It's almost that if he had a dollar, then why type if you have a dollar? You know, I could spend the dollar. And I understand that feeling, believe me. So it's like, wait a minute, I got plenty of money to pay the rent. I don't really need to write another article and lock myself in a dark room again. But that was Jimmy. Half dozen newspapers, magazines, quitting time and time again. The only thing he didn't quit were his wives, his children, and his grandchildren. He loved children, which, given his big ego, buffoonery, bluster, you found inside this guy that it was a warm heart. Another writer from his generation, Pete Hamill, said, you know, he inside him was a broken little boy. And another reporter, Barbara Ross at the Daily News, who uttered vile epithets in front of her, and she was stunned. She said, but she forgave him because she felt he had a hard head, but he had a warm heart. And that warm heart's what you read. That's where he put that.
Were you friends?
Hard to call. I don't know who, other than one person, Pete Hamill, who could actually say, yes, I was his friend. And Pete Hamill said Jimmy wasn't sure what friendship was. I knew him for 30 years. We talked regularly. He knew my daughter. I'd been to his house. I interviewed him, of course, for the book many times. But if you asked, was he my friend, I'd say no. He was a mentor. He was a person who I looked up to as a journalist. He taught me the essentials of how to be the best reporter you can be, which is different from writing, of course. And what it was get there early and never leave until you've got every single thing. Not a complicated thing. Most people don't do it. Most people leave when they say, I've got enough. Mm. He never had enough. He was always late because he kept reporting and the clock would be ticking and he'd be reporting and the clock would be ticking. And he'd start typing and then he'd start throwing everything out because he hated what he wrote and the clock would be ticking. And That's what he was to me. He was someone to look up to as a gifted journalist who Tom Wolfe, the novelist, worked with him when they were in their 20s. And Tom Wolfe said he discovered something all these other columnists didn't understand, which is if you leave the building, you will actually be able to report something that you yourself know.
As opposed to reading it off the wire, right?
Reading it off the wire, and I have an opinion about this, which is the internet today. You know, it's no different. Leave the building and go find out for yourself. And that's the hope for the new ways of distributing information. People need to go find the information for themselves and then be talented enough to report it.
Well, Richard Esposito, tell us a little bit about the new journalism and what was the old journalism.
So, you know, the journalism you and I grew up with, Gary, was who, what, when, where, why. And if you were special, they let you also interject, what does it mean, in a very omniscient way. That's why the New York Times was called the Gray Lady. It would step back and look at it from 30,000 feet. The new journalism, which neither Jimmy Breslin nor Tom Wolfe viewed as new, they viewed it as storytelling. The new journalism didn't look at it from 30,000 feet. It looked at it through your eyes. It was narrative storytelling. So if a young boy was killed for his winter coat, you know, you could write that as a police story. You know, yesterday in Brooklyn on the corner of Ashbury and Payne, you know, Gary Shapiro was shot and killed for his puffy jacket. Or you can put the reader on that street corner. And he did. And he wrote that story and he called it Atrocity on Slay Street. And he captured a bullet going to the back of a young man's head for a man who just wanted his coat and two other boys being allowed to go away. He and Tom Wolfe did this day in and day out in 1963. Tom Wolfe asked about the new journalism, said, the garbage barge of history is filled with movements that begin with the word new. Breslin was a different kind of writer than Tom Wolfe. He said, we didn't do anything new. We did work. And what we did was what everybody else forgot, tell a story. So these two guys sat there and banged these stories out, whether it was Tom Wolfe writing about the New Yorker magazine and being attacked by everyone from J.D. Salinger, who never came out of his cocoon, did to attack Tom Wolfe, to Breslin being accused of making up people and making up quotes. Abe Rosenthal, the legendary New York Times editor, who was also a racist and an anti-gay bigot. But and I can't ever forget that about him. But he followed Breslin to a bar in Queens, doubting that these people could be real. And he walked into the bar and there they were. There is this 400-pound bookmaker who he thought Jimmy made up. They thought Tom Wolfe made up his quotes. Tom Wolfe didn't have to make them up. They were so good that he just wrote them down. And, you know, these guys created journalism that engaged you in a deep, visceral, in your gut way, in your heart way. And they could see with what someone called emotional clarity. They gave you emotional clarity about an event. The phenomenal gift that journalism had lost. Where you would find it mostly was in the sports pages, where sports writers knew somebody's going to give them the score in the first sentence, but I'm going to tell them what it was like to be Mickey Mantle, who had been out drinking all night and now was got to hit a home run or the Yankees were going to lose. I'm going to be there. Murray Kempton wrote about Willie Mays in, I forget how many thousand words for Esquire magazine. I think it was like 2,800 words. What did he capture about Willie Mays? It was the last season he ever played. He went back to baseball to play for the Mets. The Mets had been horrible, impossible, never could win anything, pennants. Willie Mays, Murray Kempton explained, he'd been playing baseball before the guy who was about to throw the pitch was born. Mm-hmm. And there you capture everything you needed to know about Willie Mays. He threw in jazz musicians. He threw in famous writers. That's the way Murray wrote. And he captured, this was a man who knew more ways to win in a baseball game than you could imagine. And he told you a couple of the ways Willie could win. Faking you out by stopping at third base so you think he wasn't going to run to home, getting the next guy. And you read this and you say, this is storytelling. And Murray was another one of the people who was there. Gay Talese at the Times is another. And in a parallel universe over here was Hunter Thompson. He's a bit younger, a bit more
outrageous.
Yeah, outrageous. But when you read it, Hunter Thompson's story, you were in the story. You were there. It was a novel. These guys, as Tom Wolfe said, they replaced the novelist in the 20th century. The novel had been where everyone wanted to go in newspaper. I'm going to write my novel. I'm never going to work in this newsroom again. I can't wait to write a novel. I'm never going to work in a newsroom again. That's that basically, if you walked into a newsroom, there were 20 people writing a novel, all of whom were writing obituaries, crime briefs, political coverage. But they were out of here as soon as they wrote a novel. And Tom Wolfe said they surpassed the novelist. And yet both he and Jimmy Breslin continued to write novels.
And Pete Hamill as well.
And Pete Hamill, who wrote, I think, 20, you know. Yeah. Jimmy wrote 16 books. Tom Wolfe wrote a dozen more. But the nonfiction novel was what the new journalism was. Mm-hmm. It was a way that you could learn the story of Gary Shapiro, who got the coat lost on the corner in Brooklyn when a guy shot him in the back of the head, where the coat was bought, how much the coat weighed. All that was interesting, but what was really interesting was what Shakespeare found interesting, human drama. And that's what you got in these stories in a way that far transcended the third person narrative. And that's, I mean, if you wanted the quick and dirty, what is new journalism? That's the quick and dirty, what is new journalism?
Was Jimmy Breslin an intellectual? What was his education?
Well, those are two different things, right?
Yes.
His education was, he claimed sometimes to go to high school. He claimed sometimes to have finished college. He claimed that he was told, stop going. Listen, you're never going to cut it. You just get a job at a paper. You don't care about anything at school. Was he an intellectual? Pete Hamill went through his desk drawers one day when Jimmy wasn't in the office, and he found, you know, a volume of W.H. Auden's poetry. He acted, as Tom Wolfe said, like a cabbie in a cocked hat, but he was deeply intellectual. If you talk to him about politics, you would just see a wonderful intellect, a great understanding of politics. If you talk to him about crime, he had the deep understanding of the system, the criminal justice system, that so many people try and write about systemically, but he wrote about humanly. So he was an intellectual in the good and great sense of the word. So was Hemingway, but they both wrote with short declarative sentences. And what's the point of saying I'm an intellectual? Norman Mailer would always go around saying, I'm an intellectual.
Yeah.
And sometimes you can't read Norman Mailer because it's like, okay, I get it. I'd like to learn about something other than Norman Mailer.
And Mailer figures in your story too. They ran for office.
It was got to be one of the great political campaigns. And just like Hunter Thompson, I think, ran for sheriff in Colorado. Norman Mailer, Jimmy Breslin, Gloria Steinem, they felt there was New York City was bereft of political ideas in 1968. And as you know, that was some period of great froth in our culture, hope for change, resistance to change. They felt New York was not serving the people of New York, the political class. So they said, we're going to run for office. I, Norman Mailer, I'm the greatest novelist in America. I'm going to be mayor. And you, Jimmy Breslin, you're pretty good. You can run for comptroller. They tried to get Gloria Steinem to run, and she said, I'll do the fundraising, I'll organize, but thanks, guys. I am not going to be on a political ticket. But she did orchestrate all the work. So they ran for mayor on a campaign of ideas, and their ideas were we have several thousand people going to a high school every year, and at the end of the 4 years, only 70 of them are capable of graduating. We need to fix that. We have a police force that is not accountable to the people it polices. We need to fix that. We have taxpayers, the majority of whose money is spent outside the city of New York. That money needs to be spent on education, on police, on cleanliness, on air quality in New York. So that was their campaign. They failed miserably. They, Gloria Steinem at one point was asked, what happens if you guys win? And she said, I'll ask for a recount because they didn't want to win. They wanted to call attention to what was missing, ideas. And it was like a detour, and yet more than a detour, it was like political theater. Like, you know, it was like that kind of theater that you would see at that time, street theater. And they all went to work at New York magazines, Steinem, Norman Mailer, Jimmy Breslin, some other people who were there at the formation of this idea. So they kept their day jobs.
What was alcohol plays a major role, I guess, in your story? What to what degree was alcohol a factor in Jimmy Breslin's life?
That's a good question. Alcohol played a big role in the story of, I think, every newsroom I ever set foot in, all the way up to the modern newsrooms of Newsday. Or like when I got to ABC News in 2001, if you got into an elevator and somebody had had a glass of wine at lunch, everyone in the elevator could tell. And they'd be, you'd be looking at the guy and going, wow, that guy had the time to have a glass of wine at lunch. Look at him. He's drinking in the daytime like that. We went to the Daily News at 6 o'clock. Everyone got up from their desk and went to a bar and had two drinks. Not everybody in the newsroom, but all the bosses. And you watched. I was a kid. I was 22. And you're like, they go out and they drink. And then they come back here and they put out the next edition of a newspaper. I once went out to lunch with some of these guys and I had two drinks and I got back. And the newsroom looked like a submarine to me. I was like... But it played a huge part in his life. It was a wonderful thing for him when he was young. He found magic in a glass of beer. He wrote about it with great love, alcohol, and he wrote stories from bars, in bars, at bars, and that ended in bars. And then later, it was like that old saying about drinking, you know, man takes a drink, the drink takes a drink, the drink takes a man. By the end of it, he was an alcoholic. And then he stopped. And somehow he wrote all these books while drinking heavily, and he raised a family and showed up for work. Every once in a while, they'd put an item in the paper. Jimmy Breslin says he's sick. He says he'll let us know when he's better. And that's all you needed to know, you know? So,
in your book, you talk about a piece that Jimmy Breslin wrote about Joe Namath and about in the context, you said something that Breslin said, I can't quote exactly, but about how Broadway, calling him Broadway Joe, that Broadway was really like a terrible dump, which it was for a time there in the 70s and 80s. And now Broadway is this shiny thing. It's all cleaned up and there's none of those sleazy places. And Jimmy Breslin was around to see all of that. Did he have an opinion about the new Broadway? Which did he prefer?
You know, that's a great question to talk about. I mean, these are the reasons why a book about this guy is worth reading. Jimmy Breslin had a role model, and his role model was Damon Runyon. Damon Runyon, we all know for Guys and Dolls, which he didn't write, actually. It was a set of short stories put together into a play. But Damon Runyon, Jimmy writes in his biography of Damon Runyon, came to New York and was told, don't go to Broadway. And he said, why? He said, there's criminals. They was told criminals live on Broadway. He said, what corner? Because he knew that was where he was going to get the stories that would make him famous. That was Times Square right up until Disney basically Disneyfied it, but which was an enormous public good in a certain sense. It cleaned up a neighborhood. It made it viable. It made it a place where people could go where people weren't getting gold chains ripped off their neck. Theater goers were not considered at risk of getting robbed every time they stepped out of a theater. He didn't have an opinion about cleaned up Broadway, but if he had had an opinion about it, it would have been, look what they did. They killed a character. I've got something I can't write about anymore. How dare they do this to me? Because everything was about me, you know? So
that's what I thought. Is there a connection other than the fact that Jimmy Breslin existed between crime and sports?
No, I think I get what you're getting at. There are two things that people buy or bought newspapers for. And that's why I was a crime writer, because I knew that if I was a crime writer, I would be on the front page as much as I could. And not that I'm at all immodest, but let's face it, you don't become an actor to be an extra. You become a news. You want to be well known, or you probably wouldn't do this stuff that doesn't pay very well. That's what you get paid in bylines. Yeah. So he called crime the main event. So sports, when people bought news and newspapers pre-internet, they bought them on newsstands in many big cities. And if you went to a newsstand, the newsy guy who sold the newspapers would have some papers with the front page showing, and some were stacked with the back page showing. Because some people bought for news and some people bought for sports. So Jimmy, like many writers at the time, started in sports. His first book was about horse racing. He lived in the shadow of a racetrack as a boy, and he said, that's all I could write about. Brilliant book about one of America's greatest horse trainers, Jim Fitzsimmons, Sonny Jim. Many Kentucky Derby winners, many great horses. But he knew the main event was crime. And he wasn't, though we call him America's greatest crime writer, he was many things, but that was one of the things. And one of the reasons is what makes King Lear a great story, or Richard II a great story, or a war story a great novel, is the power, the violence, and the action. And that's what crime has. It also happens to be the most important thing to you if you're a resident of a city or you're riding the subway. The mayor's up here somewhere, but you're riding the subway and you're on the street. You're one of 8 million people who the highest ranking person you're going to see in government is a sergeant in the police department. So crime writing was the main event and had the most impact on people. So that's where you go. There are people who make their whole careers being political reporters, and they're well loved, and they get to hang out in Washington and Georgetown and go to cocktail parties, and they all love each other, and they're all very important. But it's the, you know, the guy who stands in the rain for like the New York Post, or I don't know if there's still a Santa Cruz newspaper, you know, somebody goes to the police department in Santa Cruz, and it's a good police department. They go there and they get the stories that matter. Cars getting broken into in downtown Santa Cruz. Are they still fencing off part of Santa Cruz because of the last earthquake? Is the donut shop still selling these big donuts? Whatever it is, you know, that's the stuff that matters to you. It's nice to know what the mayor of Santa Cruz is thinking, or the councilwoman, and it's all relevant, but not as relevant as, can I cross the street at night and not get hit by a car because they forgot to put in a stop sign? That's what crime writers do. They tell human stories, and they're dramatic stories in their essence. It's a little bit of a rambling answer, but
I love it. Thank you. Well, I want to know a little bit more about you, Richard Esposito. I see there's a couple of Emmy awards on behind you, which you told me you have more, but you can't afford them. I find that to be shocking.
It's great that Emmys, I describe Emmys as like the participation trophies in softball as a kid. I mean, I earn them, and many people earn them, but they also give them out like candy in a sense. So, you know, I've got a bunch of them, and a bunch of Emmy nominations. These are for doing an investigation to CIA secret prison. So I thought I'd buy that one. And the other one is for helping to run the coverage of Hurricane Sandy in New York. And that was an important one. So yeah, I've, as a reporter and an editor and a TV executive, I covered a lot of big stories over the years and was fortunate and had the good luck to work with good teams of people. So we could do things people deemed worthy of Pulitzer Prizes, Emmy Awards. I have this other award I'm very proud of called the George Polk Award, which isn't as well known as a Pulitzer Prize or an Emmy, but is probably more prestigious because you really have to earn it. And the people who get them really did good. And there's one, I think, newspaper in Marin County, a small newspaper up there has won it. They really look for the work. And they're given out by a college on Long Island University. And they're really carefully screened and judged. So I'm most proud of that one. When you put it on your resume, people don't even know what it is. I was talking to a lady who owns a newspaper chain, and she wanted some advice on her how to win awards for her. She's got about 80 newspapers. And she said, Pulitzer, I'd like to win a Pulitzer for my chain or even a Polk Award. And I was laughing. I was like, well, that one might be a little, they're both not easy, and that one's probably harder.
Give out to you. For what did you win your Polk Award? What was your?
I looked into the harsh interrogation techniques of the CIA and where the secret prisons were located. Now, the Washington Post did a wonderful job on these, and I did a very good job on it. Dana Priest did it for the Washington Post ad nauseum. She broke many of these stories. We did too at ABC News. And that's what that's for. And it was a small team of people who barely get it on TV because they felt it wasn't a visual story. It's a challenge of every medium, and that's the challenge for TV. We fought that onto TV. It took us quite a while. We put it out to speak to your question about medium. They didn't want it. So what we decided to do was we'd write it all and we'd push it out online. Within an hour, it had been picked up in 107 countries. And then the show came in and said, maybe we want that on tonight after all.
And so was this on the nightly news or Nightline?
It was ABC News. Yeah. Uh-huh. It was at ABC News. Nightline, I loved working for Nightline. People used to tease me. I was the youngest rookie and oldest rookie in TV. I started in my 40s. And I started doing half hours and hours for Nightline. Somebody said, most people spend their whole career. You started, it's been downhill ever since then. But because of 9/11, I was the police reporter. And 9/11 is essentially a police story. Somebody blew up two buildings in Manhattan and, 3,000 people were killed. That's a crime. And I basically spent a year of my life, like many of the working people, at Ground Zero. And so I did these with my partner, whose name is on the book, Ted Gerstein. He does a lot of reporting with me. We've done 23 years of work together. Ted and I were down there all the time, and we spent 6 months at a police academy capturing the Knicks class of cops, 3 months at a firehouse, capturing the next firefighters after the ones who died. Nightline was a wonderful place to do journalism. They really let it breathe and give you a chance to tell stories. And we didn't use correspondence. Most of the stories were done documentary style. They were open to storytelling. Ted Koppels did a wonderful job of bringing home good journalism to people. And that's of course, it went from 11 to 12 to I don't know where it is. The pieces got shorter and shorter and the budgets got smaller and smaller. That's gone now. So hopefully something will replace it.
I hope so. Yeah, no, I was a fan of Nightline. And I was really happy to have Ted Koppel on this show once. It'd be fun. You mentioned something about 9/11 that I want to follow up on, if you don't mind. Wouldn't it have been better if the government of the United States had approached it as a crime story rather than as a war story?
One of the great things about my career is I spent about 2 days in Washington.
Yeah.
and when I was a boss, I would go once a month and I'd get in, I'd take the Acela down in the morning and I'd try and get home that night unless I had some folks I wanted to see. And then I'd stay a day or so. I have less than no regard for the decision-making process that goes into getting us into wars as it's done with, while weighing all the political realities. It's just a terrible way we do business. I thought it was great to go into Afghanistan, and I thought 30 days in, we were done. We stayed 12 years. You know, when I was a boy, we were in Vietnam. Kids from my neighborhood were getting killed. I was at the very end of the draft move. I got the last draft card in my neighborhood, I think. I was like, they weren't taking anybody anymore. We didn't belong there at all. This is not about our soldiers. They did an incredible job being soldiers. They're all 18 years old and they come from bad neighborhoods or the South. That's where you get your soldiers, you know, from poor people. Yeah. Or where we got them. So had they treated it as a crime story, focused on bin Laden, focused on the terrorists, and not made it into a geopolitical thing, it would have been more within my understanding. How about that?
Very, very well done. The politics, you mentioned that you interviewed Jimmy Breslin for this book. So, I mean, he knew that you were writing this book?
Oh, yeah, yeah. His family was very cooperative. I interviewed Jimmy, his wife, Ronnie Eldridge. His sons were incredibly generous with their time. I interviewed sons dozens of times, and then the follow-ups were endless amount of text messages. He was older. His answers were more convoluted. I was fortunate in that I had friends who'd interviewed him, and they never used their interviews, so they graciously gave me their interviews. I went around collecting everything I could find about Jimmy talking about Jimmy, so to supplement my interview. And in the book, I you know how reporters are. They said, just use it, but I yes. put everybody's name
yeah,
on
you
it.
You credit because, everybody.
That was nice of them to say, just use it, but they did the interview, so they get the credit. Martin Dunn gave me two long interviews with Jimmy, and Marie McGovern, his partner. He knew it, and in Jimmy's world, he could care less if it was about him. He was just happy this guy's writing a book, I'm going to help him. He did that with people everywhere. I did a call-in show like yours called, All of It with Allison Stewart in New York. Mm-hmm. And about, let's call it half a dozen people called in. They were from all over America. And each one of them had met this guy. Oh, you know, he was in a restaurant. He was going to court and it was my husband's birthday. And I said, would you say hello to my husband? Give me the phone. When he died, despite his miserable nature at times, his public posturing, Facebook had hundreds of young journalists recalling every one of them. He taught me this. He told me this. When I met him here, he said, do it this way. He was incredibly generous to people with his knowledge and his encouragement. I mean, he called me several times. This reporter, she's coming up. You should get her. She's a good one. Trust me. He was always, always caring about Michael Daly, who's gifted. Michael is 73 now. And when I was young, Michael would give me advice. Michael's followed Jimmy's Michael's got his own voice, his own style. It's not a copycat. He's just someone who Breslin taught. Again, that's a part of the guy that I try to capture. That's why I think it's important. His legacy, I was asked the other day, what's Jimmy's legacy? His legacy is not even what he wrote. His legacy is do good journalism. And that's what he taught young people. He didn't care what you worked for, who you worked for. He just cared that you told the truth. Go tell the truth. Hold them accountable. They're not your friends. Mario Cuomo's son, Andrew, who was a governor as well as Mario Cuomo in New York, he said what his father I asked him about his father and Jimmy. He said, neither of them could really have friends. They were both obsessed with what they did. He said, but my father explained something to me. He said, Jimmy and I have different jobs. Mine is to run the state of New York, and his is to hold me accountable. And don't ever forget that they're different jobs. And that's the difference between a Washington reporter most of the time and a cop reporter.
Yeah, I mean, you said that, you know, you would interview him and talk to him, but you also said that you once told him, you know, that he didn't fire him exactly, but you, I mean, he didn't hold a grudge.
He didn't blame me. We had a meeting. He had a bigoted outburst. He yelled at the top of his lungs about a young woman reporter who didn't like what he wrote and sent a letter of emails to him and his boss, which I think is what put him over the top. And he came out of his office screaming and yelling vulgarisms. So a petition was circulated. People wanted action. We were going to figure out what to do to him. Then he went on radio and doubled down on his insults on one of these talk radio, you know, those shows that are like the O'Reillys of their time, you know, the Howard Stern.
Yes.
We had a meeting and we're fire him, we suspend him. I said, look, let's just suspend him. I was like 30 something. They said, you do it. I was like, no, you tell him, not you do it. You tell him. I didn't have the authority to do it. So I called him to tell him and he started screaming at me. He said, you're nothing but a clerk. You were a clerk when I met you, which is true. And you're still a clerk now. I said, well, that's great, Jimmy. And tell that you work for that little, that I know it's him, and I'll piss on his grave and I'll never speak to him again. And they never spoke again. My boss and he never spoke again. And they'd been close since they were young people, went in their 20s at the Herald Tribune. Now it was in the 1992 in New York at Newsday. So then I had to write his apology for him. So I wrote it, read it, and he said, repeated that you can't write, you're a clerk. Here, take this down. Once again, I am no good. Breslin. Then he hung up on me. But by the next week, we were talking again, and it was fine. I did what I had to do. That was my job, and I was right, and he was wrong. And you wonder if a guy like him could make it in a modern newsroom, which I imagine you're wondering.
Yes.
And the answer is, you're doing what you do, and I'm doing what I do. People change, people evolve. He probably could have, if his ego didn't get the better of him. Some people, whether it's Richard Burton or Jimmy Breslin, they don't get there. They stay where they were, and they become, you know, in a sense, out of step with time, which is what he was at that moment. At that moment, when he had that outburst and we suspended him, at that moment, he was out of step with time. Time had passed by the mores of a newsroom that he grew up in.
Well, do you think there was genuine prejudice within him, or this was just a manner of expression that people used?
You know, I've had a couple of arguments about that. And the arguments are, there are people who believe if you have one bigoted outburst, you're a bigot, and that's not the only time you were a bigot. There are other incidents somewhere in you. Mm-hmm. That's a little like the Catholic Church, where you're guilty even though you didn't commit the sin, but you were thinking of it. it's not an exact analogy, but this is a man who championed the civil rights movement. This is a man who was at Selma in schools where kids had no books. He's a man who was with Martin Luther King. He was with Malcolm X. He was with Bobby Kennedy, John F. Kennedy. A man who black prosecutors in New York, he helped with their college tuition. Is this a bigot? No, it's a complicated human being that had some bigotry in him, had a lot of anger in him. We all have biases and prejudices. Some of them come from our upbringing. Some of them come from our era. Some of them come from people who are just nasty. But he wasn't just nasty. That's what he wasn't. And we know plenty of people who are. We read about him in the papers every day. So So no, I don't think that's a very fair characterization of him. I objected strongly to it when it was raised with me because it diminishes a whole human being and puts them in a box. And that's exactly what he tried not to do. So if you have any emotional clarity, you don't do that. If you have any charity, you don't do that. My mother always taught me that charity is not about the giving. It's about the attitude. And it's about understanding. And then maybe people will do the same for you. And that's what he did. Miserable man that he could be.
And he was a very religious man.
He was Catholic. He was born and raised Irish Catholic in a city that was heavily Irish Catholic, with a police department and political regimes that were Irish Catholic. So he was religious or spiritual. He despised the fake rituals of the Catholic Church, these priests who abused children, a lot of children, thousands and thousands and thousands of children, and who were essentially hypocrites. And they, you know, he believed in God, and he believed in the things that make for godly people: charity, clarity, telling the truth, doing good. He said when his first wife, Rosemary, died, they had the mass at his kitchen table in his house in Queens. And he said, and that's all the cathedral a real priest needs. And so in many ways, when I think of how he thinks of religion, you think of the Tao and how rituals, the husk of faith. So all the trappings of the Catholic Church aren't really what the religion is. The religion is the belief in a God and the belief in the practices daily, not in the future, some place you might get to, but in the now, the place you are. So yeah, that's the, if that explains what I think of him as a religious person. Speaking as someone else who did 12 years of religious schools, I have some qualification for what the bullshit is and what they teach you when they're doing a good job. So the Jesuits, which is where I got stuck, they were good at both.
We've been talking with Polk Award winner Richard Esposito. He is the author of a new book. It's called Jimmy Breslin, The Man Who Told the Truth. And Richard Esposito, it's really been a pleasure chatting with you. Thanks for making some time for my show.
Thanks for having me. It's really great to talk to you. And I feel like I'm in Santa Cruz, which I miss very much. I really thank you so much for having me.
Lissa Warren joins me now. She is from the Bookshelf book contributor. She is the founder and president of Lissa Warren PR, a company that specializes in book and author publicity. She teaches at Emerson College in Boston, and she's active on Twitter @Lissa_Warren, something like that. And she joins me here frequently on From the Bookshelf. Lissa Warren, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Gary.
I didn't quite get it right, but you can tell us.
Close enough. @Lissa_Warren
on the
Twitter, also known as the X.
Right.
Yeah.
Are you going to move to the other thing?
I am thinking of moving to Blue Sky. That's what it's called, right?
Mm-hmm.
It sounds like an auto parts store or something. I don't know. But yes, I'll get there eventually, I think. I'm always a late adopter. What's the phrase for it? I'm never early because I'm old. So I'll let other people figure it out and work out the kinks.
And then join you.
Then I'll join.
Yeah, me too. Well, what have you been reading, Lissa?
I've been reading A Question of Paternity by David Tarashuk. The subtitle is My Life as an Unaffiliated Reporter. Now, if his name is at all familiar to you or your listeners, it may be because he was a regular contributor to PBS for many, many years. And he's also been in documentaries that have appeared on things like CNN and A&E and the History Channel. Brilliant man, wonderful TV voice and TV personality. But this book is not only about his life as a reporter. It really is more, in many ways, about his life as a man who doesn't know who his father is. He traveled the world questioning perpetrators and victims of war and injustice. He spent decades honing his skills as a journalist, getting tyrants and the oppressed to to divulge their secrets. But the one secret that always eluded him was that of his own origins. His mom, who he called Hilda, the one person who knew, refused to tell him who his father was. In his 50s, after a really tense exchange or two with her, she sent him a fax, stating that she had been raped by a priest at the age of 15 in the small Scottish borderland town where he had been raised. And so began his quest to determine the priest's identity. The police got involved, so did the Catholic Church. DNA tests were done, but the only result of a decades-long inquiry was cousins, like a lot of cousins in, ready for this, Germany, which made like no sense. He had no ties to Germany that he knew of. So began more years of investigations and more dead ends. Could his mother, who was long gone by now, have been lying about the priest? Could rumors of her, quote, walking out, which I guess is what they called it back then, with a German prisoner of war housed at a nearby prison camp, be the real story behind his birth? And if so, why would his mother have gone to such great lengths to keep the prisoner's identity a secret? So it's a wonderful book with many twists and turns. And, you know, you're probably asking, does he ever figure out his father's identity? Well, I'm not going to divulge that here. I want people to read the book because it's wonderfully crafted. But I will tell you that, you know, he is so thoughtful about this whole process and about all of this that you kind of come to realize that even if he doesn't discover his father's identity, he might still find some peace. You know, you kind of find yourself hoping that for him, however it turns out. But the whole book in general just explores the way that our background can shape us and how it's really, really hard to know who you are when you don't know whose you are. I thought it was just a beautifully done book.
And it's, you know, regardless of how it ends, it's a satisfying story.
I found it to be very satisfying. Yes, I think the satisfaction for me came in the storytelling ability that he has. And I kind of felt like I had gone to the Scottish borderlands by the time I was done with this book, which was an area of the world that for some reason I had never realized existed. You know, I'd never really thought of that little bit of land between Ireland and Scotland. I'd never given it a moment's thought, and now I'm fascinated by it.
Yeah. That sounds great. Tell us the name and the author one more time.
A Question of Paternity, My Life as an Unaffiliated Reporter by David Tereshchuk, and is published by a small press called Envelope Books that's doing some wonderful things. And the cover of the book almost looks like a piece of airmail. Really cool cover, too. Check it out.
Well, we always trust your choices, Lissa Warren. Thank you so much for bringing that one to us here on From the Bookshelf. It's good to talk to you.
You too.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next time. I'm Gary Shapiro. Take care. See you soon.